welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Once a week, I set aside time, an hour or more, to go in depth on a particular issue that I believe that the major media, even the alternative media, is not addressing, or if so, not in an honest and objective manner. Normally, I have a panel. Today, just myself. This is a commentary based upon a lot of research from many individuals who have spent years in original, in-depth investigative reporting. Final report prepared by Dr. Nancy Ashley, one of our scholars in residence, and myself. It is called The Politics of Medicine. And for those of you who are seeking the truth as to why we are not further ahead after spending more money on medical care in the United States than anything else, this year, we will approach nearly $3 trillion, and every year it goes up about 12 to 14%. You would assume spending more money than any other nation in the world, in fact, more than any other two nations in the world, on healthcare, that we would be the healthiest people. We are not. In 2012, America has become the most over-medicated society in history. Indeed, there is a medication for every condition, and we believe these medications will make us happy and slender and full of energy and attractive, like the people in the television ads. We're even told that we don't take enough medications, and as a result, the list of made-up diseases grows longer and longer. We now have restless leg syndrome, social anxiety disorder, overactive bladder disorder, prediabetes, adult ADD, and it goes on. We never stop to question, why do we need all these drugs? We never even notice that they aren't making us better, or that we can't get off of them once we start taking them. In fact, frequently, we're worse. Why do we refuse to see that despite all these medications, we're nonetheless the sickest industrialized nation on earth? America doesn't profit from prevention. There are no preventative programs for cancer, heart disease, arthritis, dementia, Alzheimer's, or diabetes. For a simple reason, it would compete with the massive profits of the medical industrial complex. So instead, we have become a nation of gluttons. We sublimate our anxiety and fears and frustrations and sense of helplessness and impotency with comfort foods. And the government encourages us, instead of offering us an honest look at cause and effect, protecting the financial interests of the fast food industry, the makers of potato chips, soft drinks, sugary beverages, hamburgers, steaks, desserts, genetically engineered corn, and pesticides, are a compliant FDA and USDA whose leaders have been handpicked by the White House to represent the interests of manufacturers. There will be no advocacy from Congress whatsoever to help you improve your health. We have a Surgeon General who does nothing. U.S. Public Health Service Director, CDC Director, FDA Director do nothing to encourage us into what we clearly know from all the good science. Ah, but there is the rub. Recently on 60 Minutes, there was the first story that they have done showing, with the Dr. Gupta, the dangers of sugar. In fact, he seemed rather incredulous. You mean, said Dr. Gupta, that sugar's really bad? And the expert said, yes. Now, why this is particularly important is because I wrote my first article on the dangers of sugar in 1970, and have written dozens since, chapters and books, debated Dr. Elizabeth Whalen from the American Council on Science and Health on NBC Network, have debated dozens of times leading advocates who represent the trade groups on everything from saccharin to refined carbohydrates to sugar. In all instances, I represented an alternative point of view. In all instances, they represented the official position. And hence, no matter how many of us have said that sugar in the amounts we're consuming is dangerous, no matter how many articles we had from peer-reviewed literature, which were in the dozens, showing sugar's association in the normal amount we take to cancer and tooth decay, gum disease, heart disease, obesity, diabetes, we were not given any time or attention. We were not given any respect. To the contrary, myself and others were attacked. We were attacked by people who have no credibility, the quackbusters, who the New York Times and other publications actually used as experts. Did they investigate their background? Did they see they had no expertise in the fields in which they were claiming experts? No, they did not. But it was official. So as of 60 Minutes proclaiming that there is a link between sugar consumption and the normal amount taken and disease, now suddenly it is a new reality. But looked at a different way, it means this. Truth and reality only exist when they are officially proclaimed. So two nights before 60 Minutes, there was no official acceptance that sugar and disease were associated. Imagine the frustration of all the dietitians, medical doctors, nurses, all the holistic chiropractors and homeopaths, all the people working in the fields of public health who have intuitively or scientifically proven that sugar is damaging, changed people's diets, have seen remarkable benefits with their patients, and yet with not a single exception, were never given the opportunity to show, hey, look what they're doing here, for a simple reason. You have to look at how everything in medicine works, and it works this way. There is only one truth ever allowed, and that is the official truth. So if the official truth has to come from official organizations, the American Medical Association, the American College of Physicians and Surgeons, the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Public Health Service, all these agencies, private foundations, and private groups are official. The major media are official. There's the official left and the official right, but they're still official. They have official spokespersons who never ask the hard questions, will never do the independent research, even if they have the intellect and the resources at their command to do so. Because what happens if you challenge the official position on anything, on mercury being dangerous in childhood vaccines, on fluoride in the water supply, on the toxic drugs given to people with AIDS-defining illnesses that end up causing the number one cause of death, liver failure, which is not a part of the 30 syndrome we call AIDS. But it literally means that the treatment for AIDS, the official treatment by official doctors, by official AIDS groups sponsoring this, is the number one cause of death. Why is it that no one dares to challenge this? There are several reasons, and in the politics of medicine, I will break all this down. But for the large overview, to begin our program, we have to understand that when a reporter goes to an official agency and asks an official in the agency for their feedback, the official in the agency has to keep to the party line. If we did not discover it, if we have not acknowledged it, then clearly there can be no truth to it. It cannot exist. The reporter will not seek any independent verification, because if the person says, I've treated a patient with, let's say, Alzheimer's, end-stage Alzheimer's, and the patient has made a remarkable recovery. In fact, there's no one else in the annals of American medicine who has made a similar recovery. And you have independent physicians who say, yes, as a neurologist, board certified, as a professor in neurology, I can verify that this woman had a remarkable improvement. And then the patient tells you this story of a remarkable improvement. Imagine what that does to the reporter. Now, you have a real human being who has medical records, a very interesting story of how they reverse disease. But there is one big problem. The person reversed the disease using natural non-toxic therapies, not drugs. Oh, what a difference that story would have meant. It would have been headlines in every paper and news media in the world. Magic or special cure treatment, successful treatment of Alzheimer's, millions to be saved. And then you would have had the scientist who invented the therapy, the drug. You would have had spokespersons for the pharmaceutical company that made it. You would have had scientists they have hired, all speaking praises. It would have been one big love fest. But it was not to be. True story. But the outcome was that if it's not official and you go to an agency, and the agency, the National Academy of Medicine, or you go to the National Academy of Sciences, or you go to the National Institutes of Mental Health and or National Institutes of Aging, and you say, I found this person who has all their medical records, who's reversed about 95% of their Alzheimer's. They were completely at the end of their disease, couldn't communicate, couldn't take care of themselves, and now they're having a completely full and vital life. Intellect is returned, memory's returned, and there are doctors who will confirm it. Which drug they use? No drug. Diet? Not possible. Now you have a choice. If you tell the truth as a journalist, you run the risk of alienating official sources. Hence, the official access to official sources becomes more important than the truth. So you suborn truth in order to get your story. And this is how it goes. As a result, think of the frustration of all the physicians who have helped patients that were told that they were inoperable or non-curable. And today they're alive and well. You see, the trouble is if you acknowledge even one single patient, you have to acknowledge the treatment. So the millions of patients who have improved or reversed their disease from arthritis and cancer and heart disease and diabetes, you have to deny all of it. You can't allow even one example, not one. And to the contrary, you not only cannot acknowledge it, but you must officially drive a stake through its heart. And hence, you will get a quote from an official source, a doctor, who has ties, financial ties or ideological ties, or is rewarded for being a good attack dog guarding the gates of orthodoxy, who will say, chelation therapy is nonsense, homeopathy is just quackery, you know, it's just water. And no matter what it is, it will be denounced by the millions. Is it humanly possible that thousands of physicians and nurses and nutritionists and public health advocates and scientists could find the truth and never have a forum for it or be given credit for it? And the answer is, what did I say earlier? There is only one truth we are allowed in our life. The official truth. There is no other. Anything other is heresy. And you will be attacked, you'll be threatened, and you'll be discredited, no matter who you are. If you're a two-time unshared Nobel Prize winner, the only one in American history, Linus Pauling, and you suggest vitamin C is good for you, you'll be destroyed. And he was. Andrew Ivey with crebiosin, destroyed. So that is how we start our investigation. Looking at a monolithic, hundreds of billions of dollars a year, giant feeding frenzy. It doesn't matter that your research, year in and year out, decade in and decade out, a lifetime of research has not provided a single benefit. As long as you stay in the circle of compliance and agreeability, you'll continue to be given the money that you ask for and more. The public will never know how much money is wasted, but it is all wasted. The war on cancer, the war on heart disease, the war on AIDS, the war on everything is no different than our war on poverty and our war on terrorism. They are failures, but expensive failures. So now we know officially that sugar is bad, but nothing will be done because of it. Because the official advertisers on the official television stations and official magazines and official radio programs, the official people who have large audiences will continue to take ads where there'll be scientists coming forward and saying, well, that was premature, there's not enough evidence, it was inconclusive, that was biased reporting. So there'll be some squabbling amongst themselves. There'll be no national effort to try to lessen our intake of sugar. And hence it goes. Everything that's bad continues. Everything that's good is denied. Hence, we have no preventative programs now in the United States for anything. We are witnessing a watershed of dysfunction. All of our institutions have betrayed us. The American media has assisted in creating this mythology. They have not only protected the American medical paradigm and the pharmaceutical industry, but they have actually attacked physicians, scientists, whistleblowers, and parent groups that have run into the medical bureaucratic juggernaut. As a nation, we have sunk so low as to allow our legislators to create laws based on what they are told by big business through the American Legislative Exchange Committee, ALEC. Laws that mandate the Gardasil vaccine for girls and now boys, or they can't go to school, and the laws that require that healthcare workers get the flu vaccine or lose their jobs. All this without the major media ever raising a single question. Is this real science or science for sale? We have decided to explore the politics of medicine and the consequences of therapies, physicians, scientists, advisors, government agencies, the media, and a vulnerable public who are unaware of how malignant the system has become, how pernicious, widespread, and in fact endemic the self-interest, greed, and bad science actually is. Part one of this in-depth investigative report will show that American medicine is not only broken, but contributes to unnecessary injury and death into the millions of victims per year. It has morphed into an extension of the pharmaceutical industrial complex, the friendly face with the white coat and the stethoscope. Let us now begin the deconstruction of this myth. Let us begin with iatrogenic death, meaning medically induced. For anyone willing to listen, the truth is a shocker. The biggest killer in America of Americans isn't heart disease or stroke. It's not lung cancer. No, it's certainly not infectious disease. The number one killer of Americans with 600,000 to 800,000 deaths per year is conventional official medicine. Now, how is this possible? What does this mean? Simply, this medicine kills in a number of ways. Adverse drug reactions, 106,000. Medical error, 98,000. Bed sores, 115,000. Infections from inside hospitals, 88,000. Malnutrition, 108,800. Outpatient deaths, 199,000. Unnecessary procedures that have led to deaths, 37,000. Surgery-related deaths, 32,000. Total, 794,936, and that is a conservative figure. According to the Journal of the American Medical Association report, more than 1 million patients are injured in U.S. hospitals every year. The iatrogenic death rate dwarfs the annual automobile accidents of about 45,000 and accounts for more deaths than all other accidents combined. As little as 5% and no more than 20% of iatrogenic events are ever reported. This implies that if medical errors were completely and accurately reported, we would have an annual iatrogenic death toll much higher. The scientific literature on medical errors is sparse and represents only the tip of the iceberg. There are autopsy studies that show the rate as high as 40% of misdiagnosis causing death. One intensive care unit reported an average of 1.7 errors per day. 29% of were potentially serious or fatal. The most important reason that medical records go unreported is that doctors and nurses are unprepared to deal with human error because of the culture of medicine which leads to covering up mistakes rather than admitting them. The one person who has done the most research in iatrogenesis is Dr. Lucien Lepay, who has doubtlessly published the most articles on the subject starting in 1994. According to him, the annual death rate for hospital inpatients in 1997 was 420,000. A survey in 1992, National Pharmacy Database, found that 429,827 medical errors on medications occurred in 1,081 hospitals. Medication errors occurred at 5.22% of patients admitted to these hospitals every single year. The authors conclude that at least 90,895 patients annually are harmed by medication errors in the United States. There doesn't seem to be any evidence that this rate has improved over the intervening years. There are many adverse effects associated with prescription drugs across all classes. Among some of the most commonly prescribed drugs, statins can lead to diabetes, memory loss, and crippling muscle pain. Diabetic drugs such as Avendia and Actos can cause increases in heart attack and stroke. The non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs can cause GI bleeding and ulceration, and the COX-2 inhibitors such as Vioxx and Celebrex can cause heart attacks and strokes. Antibiotics such as Levaquin can cause tendon rupture and CNS impairment, liver failure, heart rhythm changes, pseudomembranous colitis, and even death. As Americans take more and more pharmaceutical drugs, death from drug overdoses have more than tripled since 1990. The tendency is to view prescription drugs as safe, and that leads people to take too many pills or mix them together, even with alcohol or other drugs, and that frequently is fatal. A lot of these overdoses involve pain medication, such as OxyContin, which has also been found that regular users of sleeping pills have 500% greater risk of death compared to non-users of sleeping pills. It is estimated that up to 10% of U.S. adults took sleeping pills last year. A recent study in the British Medical Journal showed that heavy sleeping pill users were also more likely than cigarette smokers to be diagnosed with lymphomas and lung and colon and prostate cancers. Antidepressant use has become commonplace in America, with prescriptions rising 400% in the last 20 years. Over the past two decades, the use of antidepressant medications has grown to the point that they are now the third most commonly prescribed class of medications in the United States. The most frequently used medication by people 18 to 44 years of age are also antipsych meds. By gender, 23% of women 40 to 59 take antidepressants. So what's fueling this epidemic of antidepressant use? The pharmaceutical companies spend billions of dollars annually to market their drugs through sending drug representatives to meet the doctors face-to-face and through continuing medical education and articles in journals and direct-to-consumer advertising. Doctors are bombarded with advertisements for antidepressants, as are the American people every time they turn on the television or pick up a newspaper or magazine. There has been a large-scale effort on the part of the pharmaceutical industry to persuade everyone that our brains are abnormal in their natural state and we need medication to correct a mythical chemical imbalance which does not exist. The researchers have not studied normal balance in the brain, and the chemical imbalance theory is completely untested and unproven. Yet, the campaign has been extremely effective and very lucrative for healthcare providers and the pharmaceutical companies. Much of this growth in psychiatric prescribing, in fact, has been driven by a substantial increase in antidepressant prescriptions by non-psychiatrist providers without an accompanying psychiatric diagnosis. In just a 10-year period, from 1996 to 2006 and 7, the proportion of visits at which antidepressants were prescribed but not with psychiatric diagnosis increased from 59% to 72%. Now, we feel bad and we want to feel better immediately without examining why we feel bad in the first place. But these tricyclic antidepressants, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and antipsychotics all have side effects and will damage a normal brain over time. The most well-regarded studies have shown that antidepressants do not work any better than a placebo in relieving depression. Amazingly, the drug companies have been able to convince the American public that it's a medically sound premise to prescribe medication that might often offer just short-term relief, but will definitely harm you in the long term. And people find out the hard way that once you start taking an antidepressant, you can't just discontinue it because of withdrawal, sometimes unbearable withdrawal, and hence their hook for life. We have reached the point of saturation with prescription drugs. We act as human filters, and the drugs and their metabolites are flushed down the toilet daily, ultimately showing up in our water supply. Yes, the water we drink. We have no way to know the long-term health consequences of ingesting a mixture of drugs and their breakdown metabolic products. The largest use of pharmaceuticals is in food animals, cows, sheep, pigs, chicken, fish are all dosed with a variety of antibiotics daily to increase growth and to minimize the horrible contamination associated with factory farming. Not only does this practice contribute to the pollution of our water supply, but we ingest antibiotics every time we eat animal products. This is one of the main causes of antibiotic resistance in America and the subsequent appearance of superbugs. American medicine is expensive, yet we rank last, dead last, out of the 28 developing countries in terms of life expectancy. We don't stress the importance of good nutrition and exercise and getting out into nature, nor do we encourage people to avoid stress itself. Through advertising and our opinion leaders, we are encouraged to believe that good health can only be obtained through medication. We are encouraged to believe that our problems are not of our own making, when in fact, they are. The diseases that plague Americans today are the so-called lifestyle diseases, which begin with us being the fattest nation on earth. Heart disease, type 2, diabetes, arthritis, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, all could be eliminated by improving nutrition and a program of really healthy living. But in place of a good health program, we have disease mongering. We have a healthcare system that is emphasizing early diagnosis and treatment. It sounds like a system that makes sense, but in reality, this process doesn't promote health. It promotes disease. Screening apparently healthy people draws them into a system which requires many tests, some of which are invasive and in fact dangerous. One of the most often cited examples is our practice of regular mammograms in healthy women. Mammograms are lauded as a test that saves lives. But it's not true. A mammogram is an expensive test which requires a skilled technician, one or two board-certified radiologists, to interpret the results and more time for the primary care physician to discuss the results. If there's a suspicious finding, then usually there is a repeat mammogram, possibly a surgeon, a surgery suite, a nurse, an anesthesiologist to a biopsy, then a pathologist to interpret those results, then back to the PCP, primary care physician. How many thousands of dollars does this scenario add up to so far? Women are never told that a mammogram is not a very accurate diagnostic test for breast cancer. There are large numbers of both false positives and false negatives. It is estimated that for every 2,000 women who receive mammograms regularly over a 10-year period, one will be saved and 10 women will needlessly be treated for cancer, including chemotherapy, radiation, even breast removal. Many women have a negative mammogram only to discover a suspicious lump a few weeks or months later. But far worse than the fact that mammograms are not reliable is the fact that they are dangerous. According to Dr. Samuel Epstein, radiation from a mammogram is 200 times that of a chest X-ray. So if a premenopausal woman gets a bilateral mammogram every year for 10 years, it would be the equivalent of a woman in Hiroshima standing 1 mile away from where they dropped the atomic bomb. Is it really preventative medicine to recommend an annual procedure for women that will actually increase their risk of cancer? Disease mongering also takes place at the pharmaceutical level. Over the years, the thresholds for recommending medication have dropped lower and lower, so that people with blood pressure at the high end of normal or mild glucose elevation, or mildly elevated cholesterol are often prescribed medications. But of course, medications for blood pressure and diabetes and cholesterol all carry with them really high side effects, making it more likely that the person will get sicker and be on medication for life. And then you have the health insurance conundrum. In March 2010, our bizarre system of health insurance was codified into the law with the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. The big selling point to this law was the guarantee that everyone will have the ability to get in health insurance regardless of any pre-existing conditions. No one will be turned down. However, there is no accompanying guarantee that the insurance will be affordable. And everyone will require by law to buy insurance, even if they cannot afford it or face a stiff fine. What this bill first and foremost is guaranteeing is that the insurance companies will have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of new customers, and no incentive to provide a decent product that actually helps people obtain quality health care. Doctors are paid for each service, so they deliver as many as possible, or necessary, or not. Insurers protect margins by micromanaging claims and hiking premiums. And unlike the other major industrialized nations, the United States does not have a system of universal government-sponsored health care. And we have become so brain-damaged by insurance company propaganda that most Americans believe this is a good thing that somehow gives us freedom from big government. Worse yet, our health insurance programs have always been tied to employment. If you have a low-level job, odds are that you get little or no health insurance paid for. If you're self-employed or unemployed, you're completely on your own and will be forced to pay higher prices for the very same health insurance product unless you're eligible for Medicare or Medicaid. Now, this doesn't guarantee access to decent health care. However, as participants of these programs have discovered when they try to find a physician, most doctors don't want to participate in Medicaid or Medicare because the government reimbursement is so low. And with the epidemic loss of jobs in this country, the number of uninsured is rising in tandem. The perversely named Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act will not help people without the means to afford health care, but will require that they have it nevertheless. As it stands now, 1/6 of our entire gross domestic product is spent on health care. $3 trillion this year. That's $7,200 per person, compared to $3,200 in Switzerland, France, or Germany. Yet with all the measurements of what constitutes good health care outcomes, we are never at the top. In one recent year, the United States ranked 31st in infant mortality behind all the industrialized countries in Europe and even trailing Cuba. So we have what amounts to a lethal dichotomy. Americans are dying because they have no access to health insurance. Yes, but it would seem that an equal number are dying because of our current system of medical care. I'm Gary Nall. That is part one. In a moment, we will commence with part two. This is a part of our series, The Politics of Medicine. Please stay with us. Back in 60 seconds. Welcome, all of you. If you've just joined us, I'm Gary Nall. Now let's take a look at the Politics of Medicine, Part 2, the FDA, and pimping for Big Pharma. Most Americans misunderstand what FDA drug approval means. They believe that the FDA only approves drugs that are effective and safe, and that advertising for pharmaceuticals on television and in print has been approved by the FDA as well. Ironically, this couldn't be further from the truth. The only meaning of FDA approval is that an approved drug is considered to have some benefit, even if it's very minor, that outweighs harm, a fact the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry would rather you not know. It doesn't matter if the drug is virtually identical to 10 other drugs already on the market, if the drug has no clinical benefit, if the drug has serious side effects that can kill you, or if they simply don't know what the drug will do. The drug approval process changed completely in 1992 with the passage of the Prevention Drug User Fee Act, which allows drug companies to pay the FDA to review their drugs for approval. Now, since the act, the allocation of resources at the FDA has been altered, causing a tremendous imbalance in the functions necessary to protect the public from dangerous drugs. 80% of the resources at the FDA now go to the approval of new drugs, and 20% is for everything else. Drug safety, arguably the most important of all departments, commands only 5%. As a direct result, of this legislation, the FDA no longer works for the American public. It now works for exclusively the pharmaceutical industry, and the difference shows. Once the funding started coming from the drug companies, they started calling the shots, threatening not to provide money unless the FDA helped them bring in new drugs to market. The FDA has basically served this master ever since. We have turned healthcare over to business, but businesses are only interested in maximizing profits and preparing for the next quarterly report. We have been betrayed by the FDA, and that is the only way to put it. When the flu drug came out, Relyvrio from GlaxoSmithKline was up for approval in 1999. The FDA's Antiviral Drugs Advisory Committee was not impressed. The study showed that it was no more effective than a placebo, a sugar pill, and was in fact potentially unsafe for anyone with a respiratory problem like asthma. The committee voted 13-4 to reject the drug, but Glaxo complained bitterly about the unfair bias, so the director of the anti-drug division, Heidi Jolson, approved the drug anyway despite the recommendations of the advisory committee. She agreed that Relyvrio had not proved effective for patients over 65 or for those with respiratory, cardiovascular, or other medical conditions, and said that special precautions were warranted. But approval was given because, quote, some patients could expect modest benefit, unquote. Relyvrio went on to cause numerous deaths, and the FDA finally had to backtrack and issue a public health advisory to physicians, warning them to limit the use of Relyvrio. But is it still on the market after causing all those deaths? Of course it is. And so is the competing and more popular Tamiflu. Does the average American know that Relyvrio is a drug that might kill them? No, to the contrary. We've been told to stockpile this drug and Tamiflu in case of pandemic flu or bioterrorism. What happened to the reviewer who was most opposed to Relyvrio? Dr. Michael Alshoff was sternly upbraided by his superiors for his negative review and lost the right to make presentations to the advisory committee. Ultimately, he resigned. He was quoting as saying at the time, quote, "Before I came to the FDA, I guess I had always assumed things were done properly. I've lost a lot of faith in taking a prescription medication," end quote. And where is Heidi Jolson today, the woman who approved it over the objections of the whole committee? She works for 3D Communications, a high-priced company that helps drug manufacturers win FDA approval. So her hard work was clearly rewarded. In a more recent example, the FDA held an advisory committee meeting just less than a year ago to review whether Bayer's birth control medication, Yaz and Yasmin, should remain on the market. That issue was a serious studies which found that users of these best-selling contraceptives have an increased risk of blood clots, leading to deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, stroke, heart attack, and death. Thousands of women have filed lawsuits against Bayer, claiming injury from one or the other of these medications, and despite the serious health risks, the committee voted 15-11 to keep both drugs on the market. It used to be that you weren't allowed to have any financial benefit from a drug company if you were on the advisory board or a member of the FDA or CDC, but that's not the case today. At least four of the voting members the committee had worked for Bayer or received funding from them. That is a clear conflict of interest. The FDA did not have a problem with this. What it did object to, however, was Dr. Sidney Wolf, voting member and editor of Worst Pills, Best Pills, because his newsletter had recommended against using either of the two contraceptives. Dr. Wolf was prevented from voting due to, quote, an intellectual conflict of interest. So obviously the FDA believes it's a greater conflict to be informed on the science and have an opinion than to have received money from a corporation under review. You're not allowed to think of yourself, but it's okay if your opinions are influenced by money from the pharmaceutical companies. The committee also had refused to enter information into evidence for the hearing that Bayer had withheld their own research finding that Yaz and Yasmin cause an increase in blood clots. Although Bayer faces more than 10,000 different lawsuits over injuries caused by the contraceptives, these two drugs have brought in $1.85 billion in sales. In their risk-benefit ratio, Bayer evidently believes that it can afford to lose quite a few more lives before seriously considering removing the drugs from the market. But then we had the biggest killer of all times, Vioxx. The question is it better to kill the patient than to kill the drug? The story of Merck's arthritis drug, Vioxx, remains perhaps the best documented and most chilling tale of financial interest dominating over the health and safety of the public. This non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug came to the market in May of 1999, and it was touted as being far superior to other aspirin-like products for causing fewer GI problems and accompanied by a massive advertising campaign featuring celebrities as Olympic champion figure skater Dorothy Hamill and Olympic decathlon gold medal Bruce Jenner. And reportedly, Merck spent $160 million annually to advertise Vioxx and direct to consumer advertising and to physicians. Well, the media blitz paid off. By the end of 1999, doctors had written more than 5 million prescriptions for Vioxx, slightly more than 22,200 prescriptions each day. Merck's 1999 annual report opened with the following headline, quote, Vioxx, our biggest, fastest, and best launch ever. By the time Vioxx was withdrawn by Merck on September 30, 2004, the very expensive drug's annual sales were $2.5 billion, accounting for over 10% of Merck's yearly revenue. But what happened that a mere 5 years after the premiere of this blockbusting drug, the company had to yank it from the market? By September 2004, Merck could no longer deny the ample evidence that Vioxx was responsible for more than 100,000 heart attacks and 60,000 deaths. Merck claimed ignorance. They didn't know there was a problem with Vioxx until September 2004, when a 2,600-person study showed a drastic increase in heart attacks among participants receiving Vioxx compared to naproxen and was terminated early. But is it true that Merck was in the dark about Vioxx? The allegations against Merck and the FDA were serious enough that Senator Charles Grassley, member of the Senate Finance Committee, convened hearings in November of 2004. The title of the hearings were FDA, Merck, and Vioxx, Putting Patient Safety First. In testimony, a Dr. Singh, MD, professor of medicine at Stanford University, refuted Merck's claim that they acted immediately once the information about heart attacks became known, and stated that Merck's own documents show that their scientists were seriously concerned back in November 1996, 2.5 years prior to the FDA approval, that Vioxx had an association with an increased risk of heart attacks. Dr. Singh also gave evidence that there were many internal discussions within Merck about this concern. The entire selling point of Vioxx was that it caused fewer GI bleeding events and thus was ostensibly a safer drug than the 30 other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories already on the market. But Vioxx was never found to be more effective than its competitors. So if the stomach safety of the drug was negated by an increased risk of heart attacks, physicians might not be willing to make that trade-off. Instead of engaging in this dialogue or designing studies that would have evaluated the heart attack risk more carefully, Merck scientists created study designs that would exclude people with known heart problems so that the heart attack issue would be less evident. In fact, studies were designed purposely to maximize any GI benefit of Vioxx while hiding the cardiovascular risk. When reviewing the original new drug application for Vioxx, FDA reviewer Dr. Villalba noticed that there was an increased risk in heart attacks compared to placebo and asked for a larger database to resolve the safety issue. But instead of demanding more studies from Merck or acting to protect the health of the Americans, the FDA approved Vioxx on May 20, 1999, after a brief six-month priority review. A senator questioned the acting head of the Office of New Drugs, Dr. Sandra Quater, about this priority review. Quote, this person, this Dr. Villalba, who is a scientist, is telling me that we need a larger database to answer this and other safety comparison questions. Does it cause a greater risk of heart attack? yet you approved it all the same. How is that possible? Here's the response. First, it's not unusual when a drug goes on the market to have ongoing concerns about a particular aspect of its safety, because we have learned from experience that clinical trials do not uncover many events for a variety of reasons, so that is not an unusual circumstance. We also knew that we were likely to, over the course of time, be able to have additional data to bring to the table. So the doctor from Merck was actually admitting that the FDA approves drugs without adequate safety testing and that the clinical trials are insufficient to prove a drug safe. The doctor at the FDA also implied that this statement, that the data gathering after approval is taken seriously. But Dr. David Graham, Associate Director of Science and Medicine in the FDA's own Office of Drug Safety, made it clear in his testimony before the Senate Finance Committee that any concern of the Office of Drug Safety must go back to the Office of New Drugs, which has the final word on drug approval and labeling and restrictions. Dr. Graham and the Office of New Drugs tends to deny or downplay safety issues. They considered a drug safe unless a reviewer can show with up to 95% greater certainty that it was not safe, which is virtually an insurmountable barrier in protecting the American public. Now, results of another study called Vigor were made public in May of 2000 and showed a 500% increase in heart attacks for patients using Vioxx versus naproxen. Surely this information should have been sufficient to prompt some action on the part of the FDA, but it wasn't. It took the FDA 2 full years to do anything while they negotiated back and forth with Merck officials who were opposed to any mention of the cardiovascular risk of Vioxx. Eventually, in what amounts to less than a slap on the wrist, the FDA allowed Merck to add a misleading warning to the label implying there is a cardiovascular issue with Vioxx because it does not have the antiplatelet activity of other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, instead of admitting the inherent heart attack risk of Vioxx itself. Further, the company was allowed to hide this information in the precaution section of the label instead of placing it in the warning section where it belonged. So few physicians, and even fewer the public, were aware of this, that it significantly increased your risk of a heart attack. And to top it off, the FDA at the same time approved Vioxx for the use in rheumatoid arthritis without admonishing Merck for having marketed Vioxx for this indication illegally during the previous 3 years. So the 2-year stall produced a win for Merck, a loss for the American public. The problem, according to Dr. Singh and Dr. Graham, is that drug labels are negotiated between the FDA Office of New Drugs and the manufacturer instead of the FDA simply using its authority to insist that proper warnings be available to the public. A year after the release of Vigor study results, Merck issued a press release on May 22, 2001, entitled Merck Confirms Favorable Cardiovascular Safety Profile Vioxx. And it says, quote, extensive review of data from the completed osteoarthritis trials and ongoing clinical trials with Vioxx, as well as post-marketing experience with Vioxx, have shown no difference in the incidence of cardiovascular events such as heart attack among people taking Vioxx or other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and placebo. In the Senate Finance Committee hearings, Dr. Breaux questioned the head of Merck, Raymond Gilmartin, about this obfuscation of the cardiac risk of Vioxx. Quote, Congressman Breaux, I do not understand how Merck could have concluded in the press release that that was released in 2001 confirming a favorable cardiovascular safety profile for Vioxx. It seems to me that looking at Vigor study, I think it showed as much as 500% increase in the risk of cardiovascular problems with the group taking Vioxx as opposed to the group taking naproxen. Then Merck says this is somehow proves that Vioxx has a favorable safety profile. Gilmartin, the favorable safety profile referred to the entire profile of the drug, which included the impact on GI events. The congressman, oh no, but the headline says favorable cardiovascular safety profile. That's the headline. Gilmartin, well, that is also because we had data against placebo and we had data against other naproxen non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Now, the FDA sent us a letter on that press release. Now, Congressman, they went crazy. Well, the FDA sent an unequivocal warning letter to Mr. Gilmartin following the press release stating, quote, "Your claim in the press release that Vioxx has a favorable cardiovascular safety profile is simply incomprehensible, given the rate of serious cardiovascular events compared to naproxen. In fact, serious cardiovascular events were twice as frequent in the Vioxx treatment group as in the naproxen treatment group in the Vigor study." So even in this official Senate hearing, the head of Merck, the same man who issued the press release and received the FDA warning letter in response, continued to deny the fact that Merck had attempted to obscure the cardiovascular risk of Vioxx and acted as if the FDA warning letter were somehow unrelated to the very real danger of this drug. So what happened to this intrepid scientist and researchers who attempted to uncover the truth about Vioxx and protect the American public? Dr. Singh had trouble obtaining answers from Merck to his questions about the Vigor study, but persisted until Merck warned him that they would make his life difficult at Stanford and elsewhere if he didn't stop asking questions. In fact, they called several of his supervisors at Stanford to complain and tried to intimidate him. Dr. Graham's experience was even worse. Quote, "Prior to my Senate testimony in mid-November 2004, there was an orchestrated campaign by senior-level FDA managers to intimidate me so I would not testify before Congress. Our acting center director contacted the editor of The Lancet, the prestigious medical journal in the United Kingdom, and intimated to the editor that I had committed scientific misconduct, or that I may have committed scientific misconduct, and that they shouldn't publish a paper that I had written showing that Vioxx increased the risk of heart attacks. The second was that the other high-level FDA officials contacted Senator Grassley's office in an attempt to get Senator Grassley and his staff to not support me, to not believe me, and to not call me as a witness. Senior FDA officials contacted Tom Devine, my attorney at the Government Accountability Project, and attempted to convince him he should not represent me because I was a bully, a demagogue, that I was guilty of scientific misconduct, that I was just a terrible person, that I couldn't be trusted, and these people were posing as whistleblowers themselves. But it turns out that they were senior FDA officials. Some of them were in my supervisory chain, who were involved in a coordinated attempt to discredit me and to smear my name and to prevent me from giving testimony. The week before I testified, the acting commissioner of the FDA invited me to his office and offered me a job in the commissioner's office to oversee the revitalization of drug safety for FDA. Obviously, he had been tipped off by people in the Senate Finance Committee who were sympathetic to the FDA status quo, that I was going to be called as a witness, and so to preempt that, he's offering me this job, which basically would have been to exile me to some fancy title with no real ability to have an input," end quote. Later, it also came out that Merck had created a hit list of doctors, mainly researchers and academics, who had to be neutralized or discredited because they criticized the antiarthritic drug or Merck, and officials emailed each other about the recommended course of action. The Vioxx catastrophe had been dissected and analyzed to a fine degree. Most people have at least a passing awareness that this was a dangerous drug responsible for hundreds of thousands of cardiac events and that the FDA was found seriously remiss in its responsibility to protect the public. The FDA got a humiliating dressing down by the Senate Finance Committee and promised to make the Institute of Medicine come in and tell them how to improve. But 8 years later, has anything changed? Is the American public any better protected from another Vioxx today? Senator Grassley continues to be very concerned about the risks facing users of pharmaceuticals, as well as the risks facing those who attempt to bring information about dangerous drugs to medical devices to the public's attention. We contacted Senator Grassley's office to see if any of the issues raised at the Senate Finance Committee Vioxx hearing in November 2004 led to policy changes within the FDA. We were told by one of Grassley's senior staff that following the hearings, Senator Grassley pursued legislative reforms to improve post-marketing surveillance and fought hard to enact regulations that would have put the Office of Drug Safety on an equal footing with the Office of New Drugs and, in fact, give it the independence which would allow it to have some clout in its role protecting Americans from dangerous drugs. Has he seen a good result? Well, Senator Grassley has been especially anxious to rein in the different people who are involved in the drug approval process and has sought to limit the influence of drug companies over the FDA. Unfortunately, he has found shockingly little support among his colleagues in the Health Committee to force any changes in the current system. If you consider how much money is available from the pharmaceutical industry lobbyists to influence opinion on any of these public issues, then you realize you're up against a gigantic, deep-pocketed group. So it isn't surprising that most senators and congressmen are more concerned about their wallets than about who might die from a dangerous drug. In the end, Merck never admitted any responsibility for harm caused by Vioxx. They have fought every lawsuit and appealed every court decision against them, all the while maintaining that Merck puts patients first. Unfortunately, there are indications that things are about to get much worse. In fact, the FDA just announced on February 28th of this year that they are looking for ways to get drugs into the hands of patients more quickly. They will be holding a two-day hearing coming up in the next week to evaluate whether to reclassify medications for high blood pressure, cholesterol, migraines, and asthma so that patients can get them without a doctor's prescription, thus eliminating one of the few remaining levels of protection against dangerous drugs. The FDA is proposing a new paradigm in which consumers use kiosks or other technological aids in pharmacies or on the internet to self-diagnose for a particular disease or condition, determine whether a particular medication is appropriate, and decide for themselves whether specific medication warnings contraindicate use of a drug, all without any physical exam, no consultation by a doctor, and no advice from any physicians. They further suggest that if blood monitoring is important for a certain medication, a pharmacist will be able to assess results and whether or not it is safe for someone to continue on a medication. In other words, the FDA plans to eliminate the physician and the need for prescribing so that there will be no barrier at all protecting the public from direct-to-consumer advertising. How will the next Vioxx ever get taken off the market without physicians noticing that the patients are sick or dying and making the connections to a drug? There won't even be a proper paper trail or a record entry to show that the patient was ever on the drug in the first place, and without a prescription, there won't be any insurance reimbursement for these medications, so the insurance industry will gain financially and the consumer will lose. Other aspects of the paradigm include encouraging drug makers to develop antibiotics and expanding the FDA's woefully inadequate accelerated approval program called fast-tracking to allow drugs which don't meet certain standards of effectiveness to be rushed onto the market. AIDS and cancer drugs already can be approved based on relaxed standards of effectiveness, but the FDA's expansion of this program would include drugs for infection, Alzheimer's, and what the FDA terms rare conditions. In effect, this would permit the FDA to fast-track even more dangerous drugs, and that is the burden is upon us. I'm Gary Nall. To our final part today on the politics of medicine, part three, scientific studies, clinical evidence, or a license to kill. For decades now, there have been parents who believe their children have been harmed by vaccines. Everything from autism to loss of motor function to seizures to autoimmune disorders to death has occurred directly following vaccinations. Although the government has a voluntary system to report these adverse events, the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, and keeps the information in an accessible database, no one investigates any of these reports, even those of death. What could be their rationale for ignoring all of this information? The CDC on its website states that because these reports of adverse events did not occur in a controlled study, they are considered simply anecdotal and do not prove they were caused by the vaccine. Likewise, illness or death from a prescription medication is largely dismissed or ignored because, again, this is anecdotal information that did not occur during the clinical trial. The adverse event reporting system is a voluntary system to report adverse drug reactions, and it is to be ignored by many. You don't have a problem if you don't report a problem. Report a problem, and now you may have a problem. We have the right to decline prescription medication, but we can't always say no to vaccines. In either case, we should at least have the right to know what the risks are. So is there something about designing and carrying out a study of people receiving a vaccine or a medication that makes the results more reliable than the reaction of someone subjected to the very same vaccine or medication in real life? Can we depend upon the results of these studies to be completely accurate? Let's take a look. First, the gold standard. What is a randomized, placebo-controlled, double-blind study, anyway? It is a formally designed research project in which a number of people who meet certain defined criteria are recruited to participate in a program for a specific amount of time, in which roughly half the participants take the drug or vaccine in question, and the other half get a placebo, a drug that's different, or a different vaccine, and neither the researchers nor the participants know who received what. Now, why is this study good? The random selection of participants to either the drug or the placebo group and the lack of knowledge what is being administered are supposed to prevent bias, which in theory makes the results more reliable. Mostly, these studies are done as part of a clinical trial, which are necessary to get approval for a drug or vaccine, or to expand indications for which a drug or vaccine can be given. Now, the FDA and the CDC and the pharmaceutical companies and the professional journals and the medical associations praise controlled trials as objective, scientific, evidence-based, and all assert that only in a controlled trial can safety and efficacy be proven. And once a drug or vaccine has been approved by the FDA, the controlled studies are treated like gospel. And here's why they should not be. Who pays the piper? We assume that scientific studies are done in an objective and professional manner and that published reports accurately and honestly present their findings. But is this the case? There is significant evidence that the majority of published research claims may be false, and the problems start with funding. At one time in this country, most research was done by universities. Drug companies have general grants to medical centers for independent research and hope their products ended up doing well. Researchers then had the freedom to design a study to answer a scientific question and evaluate the data objectively. This all changed in the 1980s, however, when the Dole Act by Dole created a money-making relationship between universities and the pharmaceutical industry by requiring the discoveries from the National Institutes of Health funded, meaning taxpayer-funded research, be patented by the universities doing the research. The universities now make a fortune charging royalties, and small biotech firms get a product for huge profits based upon free research. These firms surround academic research institutions and carry out initial phases of drug development in the hopes that the large pharmaceutical corporations will market the new drugs. And other firms called contract research organizations have sprung up to conduct clinical trials, which increasingly take place overseas in poverty-stricken countries with no or lax regulation. So everyone wins financially, except the taxpayer who foots the research expense and then gets to pay again for the high-priced patented drugs once they come onto the market. And while many pharmaceutical companies still have their own researchers and scientists, the trend as recently seen with Sanofi is to fire the in-house staff and rely completely on research and development from the small biotech firms. It's a new type of outsourcing. Aspiring doctors in medical school are taught that good medical care is based upon scientific evidence, and the latest articles from respected journals are considered the undisputed authority in defining the standard of care for the profession. These studies provide the foundation for evidence-based medicine, and doctors depend upon the major journals to stay abreast of information vital to high-quality care of patients. But as the pharmaceutical companies have taken over the funding of clinical trials, medical schools and medical journals and continuing education for doctors and other healthcare professionals, research is no longer independent. This fact heavily influences what information reaches the light of day. Instead of providing unbiased scientific data, journal articles are actually marketing tools rather than evidence-based science, a form of direct-to-consumer advertising to the doctor. The published studies no longer have to present any data that is not favorable to the product and don't even have to be honest in the reporting at all. Hard to believe? Let's look at a few examples. Pravacol. Dr. John Abramson, a family practitioner, was interested in a New England Journal of Medicine article published in August 2000 about a study of the cholesterol-lowering statin drug, Pravacol, and its effects on the risk of stroke. The article stated that participants in the study who had taken Pravacol reduced their risk of stroke by 19% versus patients who had taken a placebo. Now, most physicians would have stopped right there, but not this doctor. And he was persuaded to look further. Dr. Abramson pulled out his calculator to check the facts, which virtually no doctor does on a regular basis, and discovered something interesting. The true risk of stroke was hidden by a statistical device known as relative risk. In fact, when taken apart, the numbers showed that over a six-year period, the people taking Pravacol had only an 0.8 fewer strokes. Further, most stroke victims occur in women age 79 and older and in men 71 and older. Yet the subjects of the study had been chosen from a younger pool, with the average being 62 years of age. Well, hold on a second. Something's wrong there. If the average person in your study is 62, but you find most women over 79 or men over 71 are going to have adverse effects and have a stroke, then that skews your study. And while most stroke victims are women, the study consisted of 83% men. So it's easy to improve results by cherry-picking a group of people for a study that don't actually represent the target audience. When Dr. Abramson examined the results in this light, he found that the patients in the study aged 70 or older had taken Pravacol had 21% more strokes than those receiving a placebo. The women in the study who received Pravacol had 26% more strokes than women receiving a protocol. 5 out of 6 patients in the study were taking aspirin to reduce the risk of strokes and heart attacks. The people in the study who were not taking aspirin and who received Pravacol had 20% more strokes than those receiving a placebo. So by selecting patients not likely to experience a stroke and by manipulating the numbers, this study was able to hide the fact that for patients most at risk for stroke, taking Pravacol was more likely to cause a stroke than prevent one. At least this article gave enough of the actual data to allow an intrepid investigator to ferret out the truth, which had not always been the case. Then you have Paxil. The story of Paxil as a treatment for adolescent depression is a chilling example of how bad the situation really is. Paxil is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting drug made by SmithKline Beecham, and it was approved for adult depression in 1992. Shortly thereafter, SmithKline started a multi-site study of Paxil for use in adolescent major depression. Study 392, which ended in 1997, had a protocol which specified 2 primary outcome measures and 6 secondary outcome measures. The results of the study show that there was no significant difference between Paxil and a placebo in any of the 8 pre-specified outcome measures. A company interested in the health of patients would have ended the attempt to use Paxil for adolescent depression then and there because it didn't help anyone. Plain and simple, Paxil was a blockbuster drug earning $3 billion a year, so SmithKline was concerned that news of this study might make a negative impact on sales. Instead of putting patient welfare first, SmithKline decided to forge ahead to, quote, effectively manage the dissemination of these data in order to minimize any potential negative commercial impact, end quote. That's according to one of their own internal documents. They plan to publish, quote, positive data, end quote, and not reveal the negative findings. The resulting article, entitled Efficacy of Paxil in the Treatment of Adolescent Major Depression, a randomized clinical trial, was offered to the Journal of the American Medical Association, which turned it down. It was reworked and submitted to the prestigious Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, which accepted it after much questioning by the editor. The author of the article blatantly manipulated the data. 4 of the 8 negative outcomes measured specified in the protocol were replaced by positive ones. Disclosures of overdose and mania were edited out. The serious side effects were attributed to other causes. The article did not reveal that Paxil demonstrated no improvement over placebo in treating adolescent depression. Only 15% of adolescents in the study taking Paxil had a positive outcome, but worst of all, the drug caused significant increase in suicidal acts. Fortunately, no one died during the study, but 6 out of 93 adolescents receiving Paxil had to be hospitalized for self-harming incidents. Instead of being categorized as suicidal thoughts or attempts, however, these incidents were recategorized as emotional lability, a term which is rather vague and meaningless. 2 additional adolescents experienced suicidal ideas or self-harm, which were not even categorized as adverse events. Internal memos at the time of the study reported that patient 70 ingested 82 Tylenol, was hospitalized, was discontinued from the study. But instead of being coded as suicidal, patient 70 was coded as non-compliant. Patient 106 was hospitalized after becoming combative and suicidal, but was also labeled as non-compliant instead of suicidal. None of this negative information appeared in the journal article. Completely ignoring the actual results, the final version of the article, published in July 2001, concluded, quote, Paxil was generally well-tolerated and effective for major depression in adolescents, unquote. On the strength of selectively reporting the evidence of Study 329 to the journal, doctors began prescribing Paxil widely for adolescents, even though the FDA had never approved the drug for this purpose. It wasn't long, however, before the drastic increase in suicides among adolescents taking Paxil became obvious. On June 10, 2003, the British medical authorities took decisive action and banned the use of Paxil in adolescents. But our own FDA was less concerned and added a black box warning advising of the risks of suicide in adolescents taking Paxil without banning the drug. Numerous lawsuits were filed against GlaxoSmithKline, formerly SmithKline Beecham, as the death toll mounted. Documents made available as a result of trial revealed that on top of all the chicanery of the Paxil article, it wasn't even written by the listed authors. SmithKline had contracted with a medical communications agency, Scientific Therapeutics Information, to create the draft article for submission to a medical journal. The actual author was Sally Layden, a master's-level medical writer who interpreted the data from the final study report and created the first draft. She sent the draft to SmithKline for review prior to showing it to lead author Dr. Martin Keller, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry and Human Behavior at Brown University. Layden also coordinated the publication process, responded to the journal editor, and provided the entire package to Keller for submission to the article, the journal. So between Layden, SmithKline, and Beecham, and the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and Dr. Keller, who I believe should at least acknowledge the responsibility of all this harm that was done, this article is still cited today as justification for using Paxil in adolescents. Why wasn't it retracted? We make the logical assumption that studies are written by the scientists whose names appear at the top of the article. But more and more, standard practice has become the opposite. The pharmaceutical company hires professional writers to create a research article and then shops around for appropriate authors to lend their use of their name for money, prestige, and the chance to earn even more money on the lecture circuit promoting research they had nothing to do with. It has been estimated that upwards of 100% of the studies are now ghostwritten by medical writers instead of the key opinion leaders who contribute their names as lead authors. So there's no question that there are no requirements other than one's innate sense of right and wrong compelling listed authors of articles or pharmaceutical companies to reveal the use of medical writing companies. It isn't stopped by peer review, and in fact, many articles are published in spite of negative peer review because of pressure put on the journal by the pharmaceutical companies. Journals make huge amounts of money by accepting advertisement from pharmaceutical companies, and even more money by providing thousands of reprints of favorable articles to pharmaceutical companies for a fee, which drug reps then make available to the physicians they visit. So universities, despite having policies prohibiting ghostwriting, benefit from the huge amounts of money given to the drug by the drug companies, and then turn a blind eye to the practice of ghostwriting. Brown University took no action against Dr. Martin Keller after he was shown to have used his name as lead author on the fraudulent Paxil article. They also never bothered to disclose to the National Institutes of Health the hundreds of thousands of dollars in personal consulting and speaking fees that Dr. Keller was receiving from drug companies each year, despite the fact that he also was receiving millions of dollars in federal research funds from the National Institutes of Mental Health. Just recently, the University of Pennsylvania refused to publish two prominent faculty members whose names appeared as lead authors of an article which later turned out to have been ghostwritten, despite the fact that Penn State has a policy against ghostwriting. To add to the irony, University of Pennsylvania President Amy Gutman is chairwoman of the new Presidential Commission on the Study of Bioethical Issues. So finally, let's look at collateral damage. Dr. David Healy is a British psychiatrist. He was called as an expert witness in many of the trials involving antidepressant-related suicide. In an article of Dr. Healy's, he was critical of Prozac. It was published in the Hastings Center Report. Eli Lilly and the makers of Prozac promptly withdrew their financial support of the Hastings Center. Dr. Healy describes what happened next. Quote, in July that year, at the British Association of Psychopharmacology's annual meeting in Cambridge, I presented data on a healthy volunteer study, conducting which two volunteers who had been blindly randomized to Zoloft, one of the Prozac group of selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting drugs, had become suicidal. Professor Charles Nemiroff from Emory University was the guest lecturer at the meeting. Quite extraordinarily, in the course of his lecture, he indicated there was research at the meeting that he felt did not have a place at an academic meeting. It appeared clear he was referring to my work, and it seemed likely that when the study was presented in poster format later that day, he'd be present. Well, he appeared at the poster, and in the course of a brief encounter, he made it clear to me that he had been approached to get involved in legal action against me. He also made it clear that he thought presenting research of this kind was unlikely and to be helpful to my career. As pharmaceutical companies roll over people who are awkward to them. Finally, at the end of November, the University of Toronto and the Center for Addiction and Mental Health hosted a meeting to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the university's department and 150th anniversary of the mental health services in Ontario. I was one of the guest speakers at the meeting. At the time, I was scheduled to move to the University of Toronto, having been interviewed for and offered a post as professor of psychiatry earlier that year. The distinguished collection of speakers for the meeting, including Dr. Minneroff. The audience was invited to evaluate both the content and presentation of talks afterwards. My talk was rated the highest of the combined scores. During the course of that day, I gathered Dr. Nemiroff made it clear to members of the university that it would be a mistake to hire me. Later that evening, I had the first intimations that my appointment was in jeopardy. The following morning, as I understand it, Dr. Nemiroff told colleagues in a meeting in New York that Healy had lost his job. A week later, I had an email confirming that my contract with the university was terminated. The worst problem with the current paradigm isn't necessarily ghostwriting or unethical as it may be, rather is the lack of access to raw data to check against the conclusions. Allowing pharmaceutical companies to own the data from research studies makes it impossible to assess the efficacy and safety of a drug. And since research isn't independent of drug companies anymore, and since the researchers are no longer the authors of the studies, a medical writer who doesn't have all the data and isn't a scientist or a researcher is charged with presenting findings. Formally, an interested party could call up a lead author of a study for clarification of certain points. Now, however, that author has no access to the raw data and cannot answer the question. As recently as 2009, respected academician Dr. Thomas Jefferson, the Cochrane collaboration, was frustrated by unsuccessful attempts to get data on studies of Tamiflu for a second review of the product. Jefferson wanted to examine all the pertinent clinical trials and approach the authors of their studies, but what he got instead was excuses why the authors could not supply the actual data. Two employees of a communications company ultimately came forward and confessed that they had been paid to ghostwrite the Tamiflu studies, which explained the listed authors' lack of familiarity with the details. Jefferson was never able to get the actual data or complete studies that led to Tamiflu's approval, and so excluded them in his second meta-analysis. Meanwhile, both the CDC and its British counterpart continue to recommend Tamiflu and other statistics from studies they know are ghostwritten, and this drug is being stockpiled at taxpayers' expense. What about the effect of these key opinion leaders on the profession of medicine itself? Academics become opinion leaders because they appear to have their names on a larger amount of the literature and prestigious journals than others. Unfortunately, we have seen the manner in which their names become so prominent, by participating in large-scale fraud on behalf of the drug companies. Dr. Martin Keller is still respected and sought after despite being a part of that scandal involving Paxil, based on that article. Many of these key opinion leaders are in prestigious university positions, setting the nefarious standards for upcoming generations of doctors receiving their medical training, and calling into question whether it is even possible to have medical care that is not primarily determined by marketing. The end result, that our current practice of medicine is based on prescribing heavily advertised expensive drugs or vaccines, which the prescriber cannot possibly have adequate information about, drugs which may be unnecessary, may not help, may ultimately harm or kill you. And if you criticize the drug companies, you may be out of a job. The published results of clinical studies are so far removed from the actual data that it is a crapshoot whether or not the conclusions have any purpose other than marketing. It is a foregone conclusion that the published results will be favorable to the drug because the company wouldn't go to all the expense for an article that would not translate into sales. And the FDA usually has all the available data. Their policy is to make no comment on the public issues if results show a negative outcome in order to protect the drug company. The issue of finding bias in research results has been addressed by many epidemiologists as well as the venerable independent research group, the Cochrane Collaboration. And the consensus is always the same. The more financial conflict of interest, the more likely the findings will support the product being studied. Dr. John Joannidis, an epidemiologist based in Greece and at Tufts University Medical School, has stated that not only do most findings simply repeat the prevailing biases without objectively examining the issue, but in fact, most research findings are false. After so many approved drugs and vaccines have later been shown to cause harm, somehow we miraculously wipe the slate clean after every incident and our faith in the pharmaceutical companies, the entire medical profession is restored to 100%. We forget about all the previous stories, the disability and death, and can't wait to ask our doctors for the latest miracle drug we've seen on television, even if it's to our own peril. Don't forget the stories on your local TV news, as well as the articles, opinion pieces, and letters to the editor in your local paper. But they're all there to promote the pharmaceutical drug industry. So in conclusion, I ask a basic question. What has happened to American medicine? We have a group of physicians who are no longer interested in true healing. We have scientists who have sold themselves out, or their institutions have been sold out, so they can have an incoming stream of cash that is never interrupted and always increasing. We have detailed salespersons, always the most attractive and articulate, coming with pedigree backgrounds from universities who go into pharmaceutical drug sales. And they present themselves giving lavish gifts and dinners and all-expense-paid trips to physicians so the physician will sell their drug. We have patients who choose to stay illiterate, thinking that their health issues are too challenging for them to understand. We have television that promotes foods that cause disease and then drugs that are ineffective in treating them. We have virtually the entire medical industrial complex that is the most profitable industry in the United States that has official sanctions by Congress and law, that has official blessings of the entire scientific and medical community, and that has the support of the media compliant and complicit in this. We have an American public, the majority of whom at this point not only choose not to know whether or not cause and effect is appropriate, but do not even question their actions. Even when they're feeding their own children to death, when they're causing epidemics of diabetes and morbid obesity in their own children, infants, and toddlers, giving drugs that they know they should not give, that have no benefit to the body at all. When people are sickened by vaccines, we are told it had nothing to do with the vaccine. When we are told that there are toxins in vaccines, we're told those toxins will not affect the body. How foolish are we? Well, follow the money trail, and with money you have power. Those who have power and can control the flow of money then realize what money and power buys you: access and control over the state laws, the federal laws, the funding, and the think tanks and the media. It's all one big happy family. The trouble is tonight, when thousands and thousands of Americans will die today due to no other reason than iatrogenic or bad medicine, at the end of the year, we will have more people die because of the fault of this system and your doctor no longer seeking to challenge the therapies that have failed for decades, simply carrying them on because they're rewarded for compliance and they're punished for challenge, that nobody will pay attention that more people will die today because of mistakes by medicine than by cancer or heart disease. Something is wrong with this scenario. But it's completely understandable because it's all officially sanctioned. And there will not be a single study, there won't be a single meeting, there won't be any congressional hearings, there won't be any media discussion anywhere about what's wrong with what is official, because they all feed off of it. They all survive because of it. And the last thing any of them are going to do is to challenge it. In response, they will be excluded. There are courageous whistleblowers. There are courageous journalists. But they are not in the mainstream. And when they do try to find their stories, and they are given the backhand, frequently they end up disillusioned. And for physicians and nurses, chiropractors and homeopaths, naturopaths, and all the others in the alternative health profession, remember, there was a time when they were all orthodox. They were all part of official healing. Shouldn't we pay attention to those who today are having success using non-official means? I'm Gary Nall. All of my statements in our report are fully footnoted and documented. This report will be posted on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and GaryNall.com.